music, and I hope everyone out there listening supports local music by going to open mics and checking out live shows and supporting people on Facebook, Reverb Nation. You know how to do it. Support your local music.
Very good. And Save the Jays play at Roastery, the place where they make all the coffee, right?
That's right, yeah.
Their headquarters, and that's Saturday morning at 9:30.
Yes, yeah.
Very good. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you.
I want to let people know that next week on the show, on March 19th, we're going to be talking with the band Bent Knee, who are going to be in town to do a show here. Also going to be talking to the amazing jazz violinist Regina Carter, who is going to be doing a show coming up at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. And David George, musician David George, will be here to talk about his latest musical projects. In our second hour, we have another guest producer coming in. Jesse Bartmus will be joining us playing some of the music that he does as Synthpol, and also other electronica music that he's into. Stay tuned for All Souls Forum coming up at noon, followed by Jeff Harshbarger with Jazz Afternoon, 3 o'clock Old G's Hangout, 6 o'clock Maria Vasquez Boyd and Blair Schulman bring us Art Speak Radio, and then at 6:30 Arts from Arc to Microchip, 7 o'clock Alley Theater Works, 9 o'clock Dr. Mike's Chamber Music, 11 o'clock Vel's Vibes, and at midnight DJ Radionic takes over the turntables. We're on the web at kkfi.org, wednesdaymiddaymedley.org, and facebook.com/wednesdaymiddaymedley. For the show, this is Mark Manning saying thank you so much for listening.
The party's over now. The dawn is drawing very nigh. Let's creep away from the day. And allow me to say goodbye.
And you're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's 12 noon. It's now time for All Souls Forum.
Welcome to another edition of the All Souls Forum today on KKFI. Apologize for the scratchy throat, but that's just what's going around. Tonight, a little Oscar post-mortem featuring movie critic John Tibbetts. And we're going to broadcast a program that was recorded the day of the Oscars on March the 2nd at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City. And it's not just a topical discussion about the Oscars, although it is that, but there's also a wider discussion of the movies themselves, the meanings of them, and the history in some ways, and of course some great stories. So we're going to have much more than just an Oscar kind of roundup show. It's going to go a lot deeper than that, so I hope you'll enjoy it. We're going to do it a little differently than we normally do. This is more of a freewheeling kind of discussion thing, so we're going to pretty much divide it in half so you can take a little break halfway through, and then we'll finish up. There won't be really a lot of questions. It'll be more of a dialogue, I think, in this particular show. So, without further ado, let us hear from Mr. John Tibbetts here on the All Souls Forum today.
Good morning. Welcome to the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Forum. Well, it's Oscar Sunday and the celebration of the 86th anniversary of the Academy Awards. The Academy Awards, also known as the Oscars, were first handed out in 1929, but it wasn't until 1953 that the awards ceremony was first shown on television. And it wasn't until 1986 that the All Souls Unitarian Forum, under the leadership of our good friend Bob Butler, created the All Souls Oscar Review. Bob sends his regrets. He is in a much warmer place, which is probably far, far away, with his wife celebrating their anniversary. Bob did know how much we look forward to this forum and suggested his good friend John Tibbetts John would be a great replacement for him. John is an associate professor in the Department of Film and Media Studies at the University of Kansas, where he teaches courses in film history, media studies, and theory. He is an author, educator, broadcaster, and artist. He holds a PhD from the University of Kansas in multidisciplinary studies, art history, theater, photography, and film. As a broadcaster, journalist, and scholar, he has hosted his own television show, worked as a news reporter and commentator for CBS Television, KCTV, and National Public Radio. He has written and illustrated 10 books and more than 200 articles and several short stories. His most recent books are Peter Ware Interviews and Douglas Fairbanks and the American Century. Please help me welcome John Tibbetts.
I'm afraid the book total has increased since then, and my hair has steadily disappeared along the way. Yeah, I want to thank Linda and Bob for the chance to come and speak with you all. Talking about movies, what could be more fun than that, even on a more ridiculously cold morning like today? So kudos for you, Oscars to each and every one of you for coming out to visit with the rest of us. It's a peculiar topic as far as I'm concerned because, admittedly, I am not a number cruncher for Oscars. I'm not very good at Oscar trivia. I know people who can tell you every supporting actress, actor, screenplay, adaption, cinematographer, etc. award that's ever been mated out. What I more prefer to do is talk about the Oscars as a phenomenon, what they've represented from first to last to now. And some of the odder things that have come along down the pike as the years have gone by about Oscars. I think one of the strangest ones is how the ceremony has almost been virtually taken over by the whole red carpet phenomenon. Studies need to be made about this because as foolish and silly and irrelevant as it may seem, the red carpet phenomenon, I guess I should call it, is probably as representative of the Academy and the Oscars and the movie-going public as anything now. And so while Joan Rivers gets off her wisecracks and celebrities appear in ever-increasingly preposterous costumes before the event, it gives us a chance really to see what the worship of celebrity is all about. The worship of celebrity. They are our gods and goddesses, our mythology. We don't have a royalty, much to the regret of people like Nathaniel Hawthorne and Henry James. And they did not know what movie stars could be like except for the stage. So here we are, having inherited decades and decades of movie stardom. And that's what drives many of us. And that's what drives the Academy. That's what drives the students still, etc. But when we talk about the Oscars, I want to throw at you a couple of things. I'm not a data person, but I do have some interesting sidelights that we could start with before we get into today's or this evening's ceremony. For example, what do these films all have in common? These are all great classics. Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, Meet Me in St. Louis, Singing in the Rain, HUD, 2001, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, King Kong, Modern Times, and Psycho. You're all going to say, not even nominated. And I could say the same thing for Alfred Hitchcock, Cary Grant, John Barrymore, who was never even nominated, Marilyn Monroe, Kirk Douglas, Montgomery Clift, I always want to say Razzle Bathbone, but it's Basil Rathbone, Fred Astaire, Marlena Dietrich. They all got awards of some kind or another, Charlie Chaplin, but they came late and they were more honorary lifetime type things, more, you know, putting the bandage on after the wound is already healed. So what does this tell us? Let me go further with this. 1952, that was the year of High Noon, The Quiet Man, Singing in the Rain. What do you suppose won that year of those? I'll mention them again. High Noon, Singing in the Rain, The Quiet Man. Trick question, none of them. The one that won was, anybody? The Greatest Show on Earth. Are you sensing a pattern here? The Greatest Show on Earth, Cecil B. DeMille, Jimmy Stewart in makeup as a clown for most of the length. Charlton Heston, you look at this film today, and I don't know about your feelings about Cecil B. DeMille in general, but I look at it aghast and think of the films that it supplanted. You could go back to 1942, the year of Yankee Doodle Dandy and Magnificent Ambersons. Mrs. Miniver won that year with Greer Garson, a wartime film. 1941, the year of Citizen Kane, The Maltese Falcon, and Sergeant York. Now, here is a year where the unexpected winner, I think, fully merits its consideration. What could beat out Citizen Kane? How Green Was My Valley. I think a magnificent film. It breaks the record of regrettable, forgettable films, nosing out the really good ones. I've got another one, 1932, the year of Little Women, 42nd Street, I Am a Fugitive from a Chain Gang. None of those won instead. And a gold star for anybody who gets this one. Cavalcade, a Noel Coward play on the British stage, produced in America with an all-British cast. Cavalcade. Well, yeah, I mean, there are flaws and glitches in this whole idea of nominating and winning Oscars. Let me go back also for a moment to 1927, when the Academy had its first inception, and then 1929, the first ceremony. A gentleman who was the first president of the Academy is somebody I've devoted almost my entire life for research into, and that's Douglas Fairbanks. This is senior. He was the first president. And I think it cost about 50 cents to get a ticket. And the awards were actually given out in advance. Months in advance, people knew who won what. All Quiet on the Western Front. Wings, the year before, had been honored. It wasn't until, as Linda said, the 50s, that radio broadcast began to be supplanted by the television. And Bob Hope still holds the record for the most times as host, etc. Now, what does the Academy do? Unless you're a film scholar, unless you are in my world where people are one-upping each other on what they've seen and all of that, you may not realize that the Academy was originally formed as a labor negotiator for the studios. This is not one of the more bright days of Academy history, because basically it was a company union designed to support company unions. And labor agitation, which was starting to go on, was being stamped down, and the Academy was the organization to do it. Let's support the company unions. And of course, we all know what that means in terms of the wages and working conditions of the people in the industry. Now, when Frank Capra becomes president of the Academy, and around in 1937, he begins to nose the Academy away from labor negotiations and unions and all of that. So that aspect of the Academy has since kind of faded away and been forgotten, but maybe we shouldn't forget it, because it was organized at a crucial time when labor organizing in Hollywood was a very, very volatile situation. One of the things the Academy did at that time, and I'm forever grateful for this because it was one of my first books to be published, was the fact that it sponsored in 1929 a series of classroom presentations at USC by industry officials who came to talk to students and colleagues on the campus to talk about what this newfangled sound motion picture revolution was all about. A very, very important event, as far as I'm concerned, because it was the beginnings of film as an educational resource. The beginnings of, let's talk about what's going on in the industry. And so hotshots from the industry came to USC to talk. Irving Thalberg of MGM, for example. William Cameron Menzies, the great production designer who later won his Oscar for Gone with the Wind. Paul Barron, scriptwriter, husband of Jean Harlow, whose death still is a big mystery in Hollywood annals. And more people came to speak. And I published a book back in days of yore in accordance with the Academy called Introduction to the Photoplay. If any of you have a copy of this and you don't want it, let me know. I think you can still find copies at a preposterous price on Amazon or somewhere. But it collected together transcripts of these conversations that had lain forgotten in dusty shelves down in the basement of the Academy. And so I got a lot of these manuscripts together, dusted them off, contextualized them, and put them together. And they're astonishing. What is the talkie all about? 1929, 28 and 29 is when these, the time period these are addressing, when nobody quite knew what the talkie was or where it was going or anything like that. Censorship was a huge issue at the time. 1929, a woman, a scriptwriter, when women still were working extensively in the industry, a cry of outrage at censorship, a cry of alarm, a cry for freedom, that the movies be given the kind of freedom that other art forms had. That's in 1929. It took a long time for that finally to happen, and to the dismay, I'm sure, of some people out there. So that was a very worthwhile endeavor for the Academy to sponsor and conduct. And the establishment of film as a study in the classroom, for better or for worse, I think for the better, was established ever since. Well, let's see. We've got the Oscars coming up. Let's kind of go over some of the nominations and likes and dislikes. And I'd like to feel free, if you may, to offer some personal comments on some of the pictures, whether they win or not. I'm sure most of you are already familiar or have seen most of these. Does anybody out there count themselves as somebody who saw all nine of the best picture? Okay. Did you guys go to one of the movie theaters? Studio 30 at AMC, I know, did them. Where else were they showing these? I know some theaters have been doing this. Well, that's good. You've got a handle then on all of them. Many of you I know are moviegoers, I understand, so you would have seen a number of these as well. Let's start with the supporting categories, supporting actor and supporting actress. I don't know if you have favorites or not. Very briefly, some of these. I did a little bit of research on some of these for supporting actor. We have a first nomination here, and that's for Barkhad Abdi, who played the Somali pirate in Captain Phillips. Personal note, Captain Phillips, Tom Hanks. If you've seen it, or if you've not seen it, if only to go for the last 15 minutes, Tom Hanks suffers a breakdown on screen. I mean, the character. It is so real, so graphic, so convincing. It's maybe the finest single dramatic sequence by anybody I saw all year, and somehow it's been forgotten. But, oh, those closing sections of Captain Phillips with Hanks are amazing. Bradley Cooper in American Hustle, he's the FBI agent with all of the curls in his hair. Almost as many as Jennifer Lawrence. He was nominated last year for Silver Linings Playbook, if you'll recall. Michael Fassbender in 12 Years a Slave, he was one of the plantation owners. His first nomination. Now, he's worked with director McQueen before in two movies, Shame and Hunger. Jonah Hill in The Wolf of Wall Street, assistant to Leonardo DiCaprio's character, Jordan Belfort. He was nominated last year for... Very good. Moneyball. Baseball movie, kind of. Jared Leto in Dallas Buyers Club, a transgender HIV drug addict. His first nomination. Incidentally, he has a rock band, and I want to cite this rock band as a special inside joke for my girlfriend, Mary Lou, because his rock band is called 30 Seconds to Mars. Oh, that we were that close. Private joke. Sorry about that. Well, there's a lot of predictions, of course, about who's going to go. A.O. Scott of the New York Times thinks Jonah Hill and Wolf should get it. I kind of think that Jared Leto in Dallas Buyers Club will get it. But here now we have the first of many controversies that go into this year's Oscars. Maybe more controversies than there are stars in heaven, to borrow an MGM slogan. In this case, in Dallas Buyers Club, you have a transgender played by a straight actor, and you have an HIV-afflicted person played by a straight actor. The LGBT community is up in arms about this sort of thing, and this comes up all the time, about ensuring authenticity by having people play these roles who have themselves experienced such conditions. There it is. Supporting actress. Well, hey, I'm giving away. My favorite right away is Sally Hawkins in Blue Jasmine. That's her first nomination. You may recall she plays the working class sister of Kate Blanchett. Jennifer Lawrence, runner-up for my favorite in American Hustle. Did any of you see Winter's Bone, her breakthrough film? Isn't it interesting to see the evolution of her as a public celebrity, not so much an actress, because she's been good in everything. Winter's Bone, written by Dan Woodrell, a Missouri writer. He's been on campus and on television here many times. One of the things I joke about with Jennifer Lawrence is the hair. The hair. I kept looking in the credits for a hair wrangler. It's unbelievable. Her hair is out of control. It has a life of its own. It deserves an Oscar on its own. Loved it. Yeah. Yeah, they were a pair, weren't they? Let's see. Lupita Nyong'o, first nomination. He's the slave victim of the, or she is the slave victim of the overseer. Her first nomination. She's a favorite right now. She's new. She's beautiful. It was a compelling role, although I wish maybe not so much of it had been under the lash. It's a peculiar way to remember the first performance by a person. The scene where she's whipped is so difficult to watch that I think a lot of people in advance, a priority, had decided not to go to this film. It's a shame. Let me just say, I think it's the most beautifully crafted, put together films I've seen all year long. And as difficult as the subject matter is, it's just a superbly made film, and I think deserves more credit for that. Jonah Hill is seeing Wolf. Julia Roberts in August, Osage County. Now, she won before for Erin Brockovich. Very good. She's the eldest daughter in the Meryl Streep family. Poor Meryl Streep. Her first appearance on film, I thought I was looking at a horror movie. Was she over the top? The question comes up all the time. More on that when we get to that category. June Squibb in Nebraska. She's 84 years old, and she may be the oldest actor ever to win if she wins. She was the wife of Bruce Dern in Nebraska. Predictions. There's been a lot of play for Lupita Nyong'o in 12 years. We'll see. Again, I think it should be Sally Hawkins in Blue Jasmine. Now, when we have some questions and stuff and we have the microphone available, I'd like for you guys to weigh in on these things. But, yeah, please don't hesitate to interrupt me at any time. My students do. So why change the circumstances? Love to hear from you at any time. Okay, best actor and actress. Okay, actress. Amy Adams in American Hustle. Yeah, I'm fine, but I'm not the huge fan of her that everybody else seems to be. Nor am I the huge fan of American Hustle in general that everybody seems to be. I just found it kind of confusing. My poor ailing brain wasn't taking much of it in. But that's a personal thing. Sandra Bullock in Gravity. Now, she did win Best Actress in 2009 for what film? The Blind Side. Who is this that keeps coming up with these? Who is that? Who's that person? Is that you? Good for you. The Blind Side. I really want to talk about Gravity here in a little bit. Meryl Streep, let's see. In her 18th nomination, which is a record, 3-time winner, Sophie's Choice, Kramer versus Kramer, The Iron Lady. I think it's pretty sure she won't get it this time. Maybe people think enough is enough, but I can tell you from personal experience, this is a great lady. Intelligent, down-to-earth, generous, giving. I've never heard any discouraging words about Meryl Streep, which is remarkable in an industry where people eat their young in Hollywood. Judi Dench and Philomena, one of my favorite films of the year. She's had 7 nominations, and she did win Supporting Actress in Shakespeare in Love, and she portrayed what character? You bet, Queen Elizabeth. The Queen Elizabeth, yeah. And Cate Blanchett in Blue Jasmine, I think a wonderful choice. I just wish there weren't such controversy here, and here's another example. Now, she has won Supporting Actress as Katharine Hepburn in Scorsese's film, The Aviator. I'm sure by now you all know that there is controversy, I think, vastly overblown because it's been raked over the coals so many times before about an alleged molestation on the part of Woody Allen with an adoptive daughter. What that has to do with Cate Blanchett's role is tricky because there are those who choose to say that the fate on screen of Cate Blanchett in the film perhaps is Woody Allen's not-so-subtle indictment of Mia Farrow and his marriage with her. I think that's a real stretch, but it's out there, as they say in The X-Files. And as I said, I think Cate Blanchett should be the winner. Best actor, Christian Bale, American Hustle. That role was totally lost on me. Maybe it's because it was too painful to watch him negotiating the toupee. Very painful. Guys, you know what I mean? I just wasn't with him in that for some reason. But there he is. Now, he did win the supporting Oscar for The Fighter in 2011. Bruce Dern in Nebraska. Sorry, didn't get it. Didn't get it. It's an old geezer movie. I'm sorry to put it that way. I've said this before to friends. I'm repeating myself. Sometimes he was sharp and alert. Sometimes he wasn't. It seemed like it was more convenient for the workings of the script rather than anything about the character itself. It just seemed wildly inconsistent to me. And you could certainly argue about that. Yes, sir. Well, but as I say, how convenient for the script writer. Because, you know, he's recovering his wits at times that are conducive to moving the story along. But yeah, oh, for sure. I just don't think maybe the movie was quite brave enough to go there. It's like a halfway trip and kept backing up. Oh, he's really okay. He's really kind of quaint and funny. Maybe I hate quaint and funny old geezer movies especially.
Listening to the All Souls Forum on KKFI, you're listening to John Tibbetts talk to us about the movies, the magic of the movies. We owe you a few messages. Let's take a short break and we'll come back and wrap it up with a little bit more dialogue with the audience. But we're listening to John Tibbetts discussing not only the Oscars, but the art of the movie making itself. So we'll be right back.
Wednesday night is Arts Night on KKFI. At 6 p.m., it's Art Speak Radio, followed by the award-winning From Arc to Microchip at 6:30. Then it's live radio theater on L.A. Theater Works from 7 to 9 p.m., followed by chamber music with Dr. Mike. Get your arts on Wednesday night on KKFI.
Come celebrate live music at KKFI with KKFI's CD release party times 2 with 2 great music makers, Nashville recording artist 3 Brick Shy playing here in the background, and Nashville recording artist Bill Kleppel. We'll have CDs to release, refreshments to imbibe, and a party going on. That's Thursday, March 13th, 7 p.m. at the KKFI Party Room. Only 5 measly bucks at the door. See you there.
This week on Heartland Labor Forum, the union election at Volkswagen has caused political and legal disputes and a reaction around the world. Thursday on the Heartland Labor Forum, we're going to interview In These Times reporter Mike Elk about the bugs in the Volkswagen election. Then will early birds get to vote? Have you signed the petition for early voting yet? Find out about this campaign from Missouri Jobs with Justice. That's Heartland Labor Forum, Thursdays at 6 p.m., rebroadcast Friday, 5 a.m.
This week on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
The choice that we all have is not only between Walmart and Smallmart, but it's also a choice on what kind of capitalism are we going to live with.
Please join us this week when our guest will be Michael Schumann, the author of The Smallmart Revolution, How Local Businesses Are Beating the Global Competition, on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Friday morning at 9:30, right after Between the Lines.
They brought
on. Just
and we're talking about June Squibb. Now.
Yeah, just to cuss. did you hear her say that?
I was there. I've known Marie a long time. We have our issues.
I love cussing. I just love cussing. And I think that woman portrayed a woman who cussed her entire life. And I think that was missed by your colleague. I just loved it. But I don't know. But I agree with you. I thought Bruce Dern was the weakest part of the movie.
And he's so good.
He is so good.
Did any of you see one of a favorite of mine, at least, Silent Running? It's a science fiction film. You've seen it. I knew that. Good for you. I agree with that. My image that stays with me of Nebraska is the family gathered in front of the TV set, comatose, hilarious but painful. So let's see, where are we? Leonardo DiCaprio in Wolf of Wall Street, nominated 3 times before, hasn't won. Jordan Belfort. Now, there's some controversy here, too, because apparently DiCaprio appeared in a promotional video for one of Jordan Belfort's more recent business dealings. What was that all about? DiCaprio and Scorsese have become quite a team. I just thought it was a little too noisy and too long, but then that's kind of the point, because it's about excess. It's about self-indulgent. And another controversy is, does it celebrate all of that? Well, of course it does. But what does that mean to celebrate it? Does it mean to glorify it or mean to heighten it, emphasize it, put italics under it? I think Martin Scorsese, like Jordan Belfort, fell victim to the resources of the medium at hand. He just loved getting into those orgies, loved getting into those scenes of excess and indulgence. And the scene at the Quaaludes that reduces them to he and Jonah to crawling on the floor is already a classic. Scorsese is a very interesting director. I hope to teach a course in him someday at KU. Because on the one hand, he can make films like Kundun. He has a Catholic upbringing. He's very religious. We'll talk at the drop of a hat about spirituality and film and other issues. And at the same time, you know, can make things like Taxi Driver and this. So here's a guy to reckon with on all counts. So it's a Scorsese film. So when you say it's too long and too loud, you kind of say, and your point is? So there it is. I have been a bit surprised by the number of accolades it's been given as far as Oscars are concerned. And A.O. Scott seems to be predicting, again, from the New York Times, that DiCaprio will win Best Actor for this, which would surprise the heck out of me, because we've got Chiwetel Ejiofor. I've been practicing in 12 Years a Slave, his first nomination. I mean, my goodness, what a movie. I would ask out there if anybody hasn't seen it, but I wouldn't want to embarrass you. How many have seen 12 Years? I'm looking for that. If you haven't, I can only say I kind of understand why. There's at least 2 sequences in there that are very tough to look at. I don't know if I need to describe them. One was the flogging. The other is when they're hanging him. And while the children are playing in the yard, he's left not quite up in the air, his feet desperately trying to make contact with the earth below him while he's strangling. And that goes on for a while. Whoa. Very difficult to watch. But that film is so beautiful. Yes, sir.
I would say it's very difficult for people to live that. And if we just don't want to look at it, we're ignoring the realities of centuries of suffering. I think it's for people to say, I don't want to go because I don't want to see that. Or it's kind of like, I don't want to know what's really going on in the rest of the world.
Yeah, I know. Over the years, I would personally agree with you, but I find myself having to be careful about registering that as a value judgment, because I run into this all the time with the students. Now, with students, you've got firmer ground. They need to know this history. I interviewed Spike Lee one time when Malcolm X came out, and his interview was virtually one long rant about why the black children of his generation and younger don't know who Jackie Robinson is, don't know who Malcolm X was, etc. He went on and on. And at that time, he was considering making a movie about the Negro Leagues. Alas, never happened. But for students, for a younger generation, I think you can lower the boom. You really need to see this. And that is a value judgment. You are doing a disservice to yourself and your humanity if you don't see this movie. To everybody else, I would simply plea, it's such a gorgeous movie. I know it sounds contradictory. How could a gorgeous movie be so tough to watch? But, and I know you do, if you appreciate how beautifully and well made a film can be, this thing is just like a, it fits you like a glove. Maybe that makes its grim toughness all the more striking now that I think about it. Matthew McConaughey, Dallas Buyers Club, his first nomination. Did anybody see him in Mud? Really, a fantastic movie. He was all buff in that. You see him in this, and he's more gaunt than the character he portrays ever was. Now, again, here we go. Controversies aplenty. For example, the character that he plays, the guy may have been gay after all. There's kind of a point in the movie that he's not. McConaughey certainly is not. So, again, controversies about why would a straight actor with no experience with HIV be playing a role like this. I mean, the same thing happened to Tom Hanks in Philadelphia. I don't presume to have any answers to that. Just note that controversies like that are out there. I think the best thing, though, all things considered, in Dallas Buyers Club was McConaughey's walk-on. And it's really just a walk-on. In Wolf of Wall Street. In Wolf of Wall Street, he appears early on as a kind of a mentor for Jordan Belfort. And I think that's the best thing McConaughey's done all year. But yes, I mean, he's a powerhouse in Dallas Buyers Club as well. But if you haven't yet seen Wolf of Wall Street, watch especially for his appearance early on. He's a wheeler dealer, and it's really something. It just seems to me that Ejiofor is the one who should get it. There's a strong groundswell for Matthew McConaughey. I think those are the two that are chief contenders. I just can't see DiCaprio in the final analysis. As good as he was, and he's amazing in it, being a rival to those. Best picture. Oh, let's not forget director. Because I think Alfonso Cuarón, next to my favorite guy, Peter Weir, is the best director on the planet. If you've ever seen The Others, one of the best ghost stories ever made, E Tu Mama Tambien, terrific film about a young Mexican youth. This guy is amazing. And in Gravity, he's made a movie that I think is too good for its own sake. The special effects have completely outweighed every other consideration about this picture, including Sandra Bullock's performance. It's all effects, effects, effects. It's all you ever hear about. And I've grown tiresome, I suppose, to some of my friends because I'm always saying, wait a minute, wait a minute. This film is really about negotiating your way through hazards, finding a balance, finding an equilibrium, seesawing back and forth between extremes. The entire film is about her trying to find her balance. Has anybody not seen Gravity? Do you mind if I mention the last shot? Because, boy, does this thing come together in the final seconds of the film. She's back on Earth now. And she's in the mud. She's on the ground. She's grounded. And she struggles to her feet and looks up. And you realize that there's the sky above, the mud below. The aspiration, the reality. She's grounded, but she's found a balance at last. All the movie, I think, points to that. And it's done wordlessly, without any big deal. There's no hallelujah chorus going on or anything. But what a superb way to end that film. And that's what startled me. I thought, wait a minute, that's what this film really is all about. It's my favorite film of the year, although 12 years, what can you say? They are so different. I think there's a strong possibility for a tie. We'll see. They did tie, you know, for the Producers Guild Awards. The chances for a tie in Oscar history would be very, very remote. But it's a possibility, and it has been raised several times. Yes, sir.
Do you think it's the best film because of the special effects or because of her acting? I mean, because...
Well, I think it's the best film for how the acting and the special effects combine for the theme I'm talking about. Put it that way.
Yeah.
The effects are amazing. But, you know, special effects are of their time. You look back at 2001, some of the effects already look quaint and hokey.
Yeah.
Is it possible that someday we'll look back upon Gravity and realize, you know, simulating weightlessness in a studio ultimately just can't work?
Well, you probably heard the complaints about it. Her hair must be glued to her head.
Mm-hmm.
In the thing where she lost her partner, all she had to do was go, and he would have been right against her. So that was totally wrong. They had the debris going the wrong way.
Were you the person that called KCUR and complained that the movie wasn't realistic?
You guys, right. And I know that you kept being amazed that anybody didn't think it was the best thing they'd ever seen.
What I was amazed at is, if it's not realistic, on what basis is it not realistic? Are we NASA engineers that can really know how it would be like weightless? Of course it's not realistic. How could it be? Maybe is the point. But, that kind of took me aback. It was the first person I'd heard complain about that, and then two others called, if you'll recall, and reiterated the same thing. No, I think the film has resonance. But the special effects thing fascinates me. I mean, think about it. In 1950-51, two classic science fiction films appeared. Destination Moon, an Oscar-winning motion picture. Robert Heinlein, Willie Ley, all kinds of people were technical analysts and advisors in the film. One for special effects, Trip to the Moon. The other film, Rocket Ship XM, a clunky B-movie made for about $180. No special effects to speak of. The closest it gets to any kind of scientific extrapolation is a scientist drawing pictures on a blackboard of a rocket and then an arrow going to the moon. And yet that picture lives because it didn't depend upon special effects. It's about people. If you've never seen Rocket Ship XM, and I don't know why you would have, but it's available, check it out because it has an ending you won't believe, and I'm not going to tell you what it is. The picture that won now looks clunky. It's the best word I could find. Because the special effect. In 1950, people did not see the strings that the astronauts were hanging from in outer space. We see the strings. There's something about our perceptions, generation to generation. You look at King Kong now, and you can see the fingerprints on Kong's fur. If it's a good quality image, did people see that then? Apparently not. What's going on here? And so in another generation, something like Gravity, the special effects may be the least thing that's talked about in it. We'll see. Steve McQueen for 12 years, his first nomination. His heritage, he's from Trinidad and Grenada. If you're going to do 12 years as best picture, you would think it would be he, as director. But not necessarily the case in recent years, so we'll see. Alexander Payne for Nebraska, his seventh nomination. David O. Russell for American Hustle. I'm sorry, ho-hum. Martin Scorsese for Wolf of Wall Street. You know, he's won only once before for The Departed. The Wolf of Wall Street, I was delighted to see right off the bat, resembles maybe my favorite of Scorsese's pictures, which is Goodfellas. Where you've got a young man who's narrating the film, you follow his adventures, it's very quixotic, it's very much like something out of a Gulliver's Travels or Candide or something, as you see him slowly get sucked into this cesspool of corruption. The narrative arc of Goodfellas is retained here, and I kind of like movies where there's a narrator anyway. Many people don't. So Best Director, I think Cuarón and McQueen are the contenders here. Impossible. Maybe some of you have predictions, and we can get to those. And, of course, we've already talked quite a lot about the best pictures. But some remarks here. I was disappointed at some of the omissions in the Oscars this year. Omissions in major category nominations for Inside Llewyn Davis, for example, or Llewellyn Davis. See it? Not very many.
Won't count on it.
Where are you?
Boring.
Were you alive? I'll put this generously. Were you alive when the folk singing craze was going on? Of course you were. Yeah. So that would have been Hootenanny and Peter, Paul, and Mary and stuff like that. Yeah. Yeah, I can understand that. I've talked to people that did. To me, it was such a carefully observed film, albeit measured, slow, and moody, and all of that. Did you reach the scene, which is my favorite scene of anything all year, when John Goodman shows up in the back seat of the car? Did you reach that scene?
When Llewyn
Davis is driving cross-country to Chicago, and John Goodman is an aging jazz man.
Oh, yeah.
Did you stay for that?
I think John was so bored he went to sleep on the movie.
This certainly his character does. That's a kind of a Rorschach test, isn't it, a movie like that? You know, I did like it very much. I do think, though, it's, at the very least, it deserved more consideration in the nominations. Tim's Vermeer. Now, yes, this is a documentary that probably none of you have seen that I hope opens soon. The most amazing film maybe I saw all year. Tim's Vermeer. It's about a guy who devotes his wealth and about 10 years of his life to trying to duplicate a painting by Johannes Vermeer. Has it started yet? I think it's coming. And it may be coming to the Glenwood Fine Arts, which is where I saw a preview screening. Do not miss this film. It will take you by surprise in a number of ways. I'm watching the clock, so I won't go too far with that. Let's see. Saving Mr. Banks was a personally disappointing film for me. I love Walt Disney as much as anybody. I've studied and taught Disney and his films. But what an unconscionable whitewash that was of Walt. Because everything that P.L. Travers, the Emma Thompson role, everything that she charges Walt, if you take Mary Poppins, you're going to do this and this and this to it, she would say, and I hate that. She was right. The film portrays her as a kind of an old meanie. Maybe she was an old meanie, but she was insightful, and she knew exactly what was going to happen to Mary Poppins when Walt took it on, and indeed it did happen, but the movie somehow sidesteps that, and it shows them ultimately as getting along, which they never did. He never went to see her. Where was it? Australia or England or something? Oh, that's all invented. The scene, though, where he talks about his boyhood was interesting. Now, am I talking about a movie many of you have seen? Not sure. It's worth seeing. But I'll have to say I'm one of the few that was kind of incensed at the way it whitewashed Walt. Walt's bigger than that. We don't need to paint him with such a broad brush like that. We can allow him his flaws, and they were considerable. Most disappointing omission for acting. Steve Coogan, who played the reporter in Philomena. We needed him as a counter. You agree. We needed him as a counterbalance, don't you think, to Judi Dench. An amazing role. And again, controversy, because it deals with the activities of a certain nun. And apparently this did go on in certain places in the Catholic convents where women, single women with children, were brought in and then their children were sold off to prospective parents. There was a movie called Magdalene Sisters that came out a few years ago that's really a heavy attack on this. Philomena gets in its licks as well. You know, my response to that is, how about it? I watched it and, well, he faces into the wind a lot. He climbs a mast, survives, and don't get me wrong, I just didn't see it as anything other than reacting to the elements. And the story was so thin. There was very little about why he was there, who rescues him, it's wordless. And certainly for his age, for a physically demanding role, it's very impressive. But I guess not. But I love Robert Redford, and the film was fine. But I came away from it as a major disappointment for me, just personally. Well, I don't know. There's a lot of things I haven't yet touched on, but maybe we need to leave some time for people who would like to bring up questions about maybe your own likes and dislikes. Okay, just a couple? Yes, sir.
I've got three questions. You can answer them. Okay, whatever you want. Jack Black in Bernie last year, Keira Knightley in the Jung Freud movie this year, and the young girl with the 2-inch name in Stoker this year. All three of them should have won or been nominated.
You know. Now, say the film titles again.
I don't know the title of the one, the Jung Freud. It was at the TIV.
Anybody know? I'm running a blank.
No, I don't know. I don't know it. No.
And then, where she played the patient of Freud or of Jung.
Right, yeah.
They're both in it.
Mm-hmm. And then the young girl in the Stoker movie, she had this, has this incredibly long name.
Wasn't that Elizabeth Olsen?
Whatever. You know, black hair.
Yeah.
Extremely well done.
Yeah, she's in a new movie now called In Secret, based on a Zola novel. It's very powerful. Well, you're pointing out the movies for specialists. And here again we get into voting patterns. The Academy has more and more been dedicated to getting screeners and screening opportunities available to the 6,000 voters. 6,000 voters, that's ambitious. Because the scandals have been too many times in the past, they haven't been watching these films. The nominees is one thing, but to be a regular watcher to see the films you're talking about before the nominations. I mean, I would also talk about Prisoners with Hugh Jackman, which I thought was really fine. Yeah, the omissions can break your heart. That's your personal investment in your viewing. I know, and I sympathize. Yes, ma'am.
For our personal investment, would you give us an opportunity to vote on a couple of the categories, two or three?
Yeah, which ones? I assume
best
you mean
movie,
maybe the
course.
Big ones. Well, let's see. I'll run off quickly the titles. Best Picture, American Hustle, Captain Phillips, Dallas Buyers, Gravity, Her, which we've not talked about, Nebraska, Philomena, 12 Years a Slave, Wolf of Wall Street. Let's go to the gate here. Gravity. How many people would vote Best Picture? Wow. 12 Years. That's probably going to do it. Wolf of Wall Street. Philomena, this is my third favorite of the year. Nebraska, Her. Okay. We've got 12 years a Slave. All right. Best Actor, Christian Bale, Bruce Dern, DiCaprio, Ejiofor, McConaughey. Okay. How about McConaughey in Dallas Buyers? Fairly. Ejiofor in 12 Years? About the same, I think. DiCaprio, Dern, Bale. So we've got a tie virtually between 12 Years and Dallas Buyers. Okay. Actress, Amy Adams, Kate Blanchett, Sandra Bullock, Judy Dench, Meryl Streep. Streep, Judy Dench, 2. Sandra Bullock, 1. Kate Blanchett, okay, she's got it. Amy Adams. So we've got 3 categories. Are we done? Okay. Supporting actor, Barkhad Abdi, Captain Phillips, Bradley Cooper, American Hustle, Fassbender, 12 Years, Jonah Hill, Wolf, Jared Leto, Dallas Buyers. Jared Leto, Jonah Hill, Fassbender, Cooper, Abdi. Okay, it looks like Jared Leto. And finally, supporting actress, Sally Hawkins, Blue Jasmine. You want Sally Hawkins, don't you? Jennifer Lawrence, American Hustle, Lupita Nyong'o, 12 Years, Julia Roberts, August Osage County, June Squibb, Nebraska. Squibb. Okay, Roberts, Nyong'o, Lupita Nyong'o. That's got more. So that's the winner so far. Jennifer Lawrence, the hair. and Sally Hawkins. Gee, I see a distinct majority out there.
Yeah, I mean, it's way, way over there.
Okay, it looks like, who did we nominate? Looks like Nyong'o, was that the one that had the most?
Yeah.
Well, it goes on and on. Red carpet stuff all afternoon. Don't miss some of that. It's always great fun. Ceremony tonight. We'll see what Ellen DeGeneres does. I'm sure she'll keep things fairly muted. There's enough controversies going on already. But I hope you have a good time. Have a party. And if you go to a party, make sure everybody there watches the darn thing. How many parties have you been to where nobody's paying attention to the set at all? I protest. Thank you very much.
You're listening to John Tibbetts, a movie critic, talking about the recent Oscars. You will, of course, know that he was right and wrong about some of his predictions, but we aired this afterwards for a reason, because it's more about than it was a program about more than just the Oscars. So we hope you enjoyed the discussion and the interaction with the audience and his reaction to some of the films, too, that are nominated or were nominated for the award this year. This program was recorded at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church on March the 2nd of 2014. This program is produced and edited for broadcast by Barry Lee. Thanks to Rita Norton and the staff at All Souls for their help with this program each week. Tune in again next Wednesday. Another All Souls Forum will come your way right here at noon. You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Middle class of America is shrinking in all ways that we measure it, numerically and percentage-wise, as well as their real disposable income is all going down. In other words, the number of Americans making decent money is rapidly declining, and what they can buy with what they make is also going down. We're getting squeezed by the same policies that always destroy economies, and plainly put, their socialistic ideals that fail to bring about what they promise, like Rome's decline so many years ago, an expanding military, onerous and increasing taxation, the ever-increasing social safety nets and programs, the intrusion of more central government into the lives of its citizens, all contribute to the slow destruction of a nation's producing sector. In other words, the working class, which is the engine of every economy, which are small businesses and enterprises. As governments grow to satisfy the cries of inequality by the masses, its cannibalistic nature slowly consumes the host, which is the economy under it. The median net worth of families has declined from $126,000 to $77,000 in a mere 3 years, although a gradual decline has also been occurring for decades. In 46 of 50 states, the poverty levels have increased over the past 5 years, with a national poverty rate of over 15% for the last 5 years running. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the more accurate measure of unemployment is well over 13%, not the massaged 6% figure you read about. Meanwhile, the cost of living is climbing even higher, despite what Washington is claiming. Their official inflation statistics tell us inflation is the lowest in 5 decades. Americans know better. Prices are rising, while government garnishment of wages is increasing. Higher taxes, higher inflation, higher cost to businesses through more regulation, higher mandated wages, and mandated health care costs, to name a few, put more and more strain on business and family budgets alike. Through all of it, we hear more talk about government enacting even more regulation, garnering higher taxes, and their grand utopian plans of redistribution to level the playing field. At the same time, Washington gives the banking sector billions, protects its crony businesses and PayPals, and answers the cry of government lobbyists with more subsidies, protection, and tax waivers. They look not to where the real money is going through the billions they give to Wall Street, but instead garner the hard-earned dollars from their working citizens, driven by the cry from the ever-increasing low or no-income earners, who Washington creates even more through their own policies. More and more people getting in the cart, calling for more and more of their unearned share. Why billions pass right under their noses to the elite, and all with the full permission of the administration, an administration that claims to support the same people whose money they are stealing to give to this elite class. Until we stop the